Welcome to another episode of Hooked on Score. I'm your host, Rick Urban. Today we are going to be talking to Osei Aset. Osei has recently scored the Netflix docuseries Amend, The Fight for America. We're going to be talking to him about the project and his score for it. Osei is here. Let's welcome Osei. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing, Rick? Thanks for having me today.
Oh, yeah. Our pleasure. Where are you joining us from? Are you in L.A.?
No, I'm not. I'm actually in the Lower Hudson Valley in New York. Couldn't be much farther away from Los Angeles.
Well, that's great. Have you been always kind of New York based?
I've been primarily East Coast New York based. Yeah. I mean, I've spent a good amount of time on the West Coast, and I'm sure I will again. But for the, you know, home base is New York.
Yeah. Yep. They say, you know, either New York or LA, that's kind of where film composers gravitate toward at some point in their career. But seems like it's spacing out these days, especially I think after this pandemic, we're going to start, as everybody's comfortable with Zoom. You know, I was ordering food from the little QR code the other night, thinking to myself, man, I hope this kind of stays around, this QR code, for a while, because it's pretty convenient. But
it's a lot easier to talk to people nowadays than ever, really. And it matters a lot less where you are.
Yeah. I imagine you do a lot of communication with directors and filmmakers across the coast, or do you kind of stick with people that are New York-based?
No, it's across the coast, but I also work a lot with a filmmaker down in Austin, Texas. So I've been doing kind of a remote thing in a lot of ways for a long time. So it really actually wasn't that much of an adjustment once the pandemic hit, aside from like getting instrumentalists.
I want to jump right in and talk about this docuseries. This is, again, is called Amend, The Fight for America. This is on Netflix, streaming as we speak. I watched the first two episodes last night. Will Smith is the host, and they are talking about the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And they actually speak about that in the first episode. It's probably the most important thing in the Constitution, yet nobody really knows about it. And of course, I went into it, you know, I was educated in the Chicago public school system, not quite, but and I had no idea about this thing. I obviously, you know, knew about the 14th Amendment in general, but about all of the specifics to it and really what it did, it was news to me. So I think it's something that needs to be out there because it is so important.
Yeah, it really does seem, I'm similarly, I you know, went to school here in the New York area and somehow managed to make it through however many years of schooling, you know, what is that, 16 years of school, without really knowing very much about the 14th Amendment, aside from the fact that it must precede the 15th and follow after the 13th. So, you know, this is, I have to admit, you know, great deal of ignorance around the 14th Amendment prior to this series and sort of diving in. As soon as I, you know, there was word that I was likely going to be working on it, I familiarized myself a bit with it. And even still, you know, while watching the series and working on it and listening to these really wonderful speakers, you know, you have these talking heads, these people that are really like the experts in their field that you couldn't ask. Like, it's every single person that's been in every documentary that I've worked in is in this doc series.
So, I mean, it's almost every single person that's been in every film. I mean, just the people that are in here are just amazing, right? Will Smith, Larry Wilmore, who every time I see him on screen, I fall in love with him more. From the first or the second episode of The Office to, you know, this really serious conversation here. We've got Joseph Gordon-Levitt is in here. Samuel L. Jackson, Diane Lane, Pedro Pascal from The Mandalorian. And it's really intense what these actors are portraying, a lot of these historical figures.
For sure.
Right off the bat, we have Frederick Douglass, and we have Abraham Lincoln, of course, and it's intense. But the music, your music goes through so many different genres within, you know, 1 2-minute clip. It's amazing. I think I got a little write up about the music that said it sounded minimalism combined with orchestral. But really, I heard a little bit of everything in this. I can't imagine, you know, you must have gone crazy just doing all the different things. Can you talk a little bit about how you picked kind of the genre for each topic?
Well, working through, it was an interesting process because I had to figure out what my orchestra was going to be. And obviously, you know, the producers were very interested in having it have some elements that would appeal to a youthful audience, or, you know, to kids a little bit, and or at least not be off-putting. So we didn't want it to be too staid. And at the same time, I'm very strongly rooted in American folk music, and similarly, I love, you know, minimalist and orchestral sort of minimalism. So I wanted to find a way to say as much as possible with maybe a lot of voices speaking, but not have it be too overly complex, because there was going to be a lot of moving between voices. I mean, every few moments, as you said, the show sort of pivots from one actor to another, from one scene to another, and that's an hour long of moving between. And there's a good amount of source music in there as well. I think we have like 20% or 30% for some episodes of score music, but it's really throughout. It's scored from pretty much minute, from second one all the way to the end. So finding a way to talk between the source music and across different scenes, it took a lot of work and a lot of finding. But I had some sounds in my head that seemed to correspond to the material, or at least the material for the early episodes. And that then was able to carry us into some of the later episodes. I mean, I have to say also that there was a lot of great work done by our music supervisors and by the editors in helping to sort of direct at least the pacing of things. If not, you know, the voice didn't exist before, but it really did help get us there, because there were so many places that it could have gone, and with that many sort of ins and outs,
yeah,
it could have been a lot more frenetic and less together than it was.
Now, when you were composing, were you composing to picture, or were you composing before picture was even shot?
There were two phases, really three phases. There was an initial phase, which happened in Los Angeles, where I was out for a few months working on kind of finding the colors. We had a different idea of how we were going to approach the score initially, and it required sort of coming up with some ideas ahead of picture. So I started there, and we actually, a lot of our colors still came from those initial sessions. But then the actual pieces of music were created in the second phase, which was scoring to picture. And then there was a third phase, which was when everything was locked. I then went through all six episodes. So that's really, yeah, it was a lot. It took about a year and a half.
For all of our composer listeners, they know that you're always, it kind of, you go through that with every project. You write ideas without picture, And then you get the picture and the director says, this is absolutely locked. There's no way it's going to change ever again. final copy. You know, even the file is marked final draft, no changes. And then you score to that. And then 2 weeks later, they say, oh, we made the following changes here, 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 and here.
And you get your underscore 01 behind the final draft. No changes.
really, no changes. Version 38. Yeah. Well, the changes happen so brilliantly in this. And I want to applaud you for the way that the music really takes you through this, because a lot of the acting is done in a very kind of modern way, where the actor is just kind of on an empty sound stage, if you will, set up, you know, it's dressed almost like a play. There's no props, there's no costumes. It's just the actor in a suit kind of interacting with the voiceover, as well as speaking some dialogue, portraying that character. Not character, the historical figure, right? So there are so many different performances in here, and I was looking at some of the actors in the episodes I haven't seen, so I think I'm going to finish watching this after we get done with this interview. But I want to say that at certain points, there are some very tough things to watch. And, you know, it's kind of our national shame of slavery and all the hatred stuff that we are dealing with as a culture still in America. And the music that you bring in for that, it brings it home. It's one of those things, whenever you see an actor portray a bad guy and you really hate that actor, I think to myself, that's a great actor because I hate that character so much. And when you bring this music that just drives home all of these issues of slavery and the when the Ku Klux Klan is referred to in there, and for the first time, the music, it's so heavy and it's so effective that must have just been an intense experience writing that. What was that like?
Yeah, well, you know, I think one of the reasons that it was a very tough experience, and it often is. I think for composers working in documentary especially, it's not often that we get to tell light stories. I mean, every once in a while you do, and that's great. There's a great pleasure there. But I think so many of the important stories that deserve telling are violent and brutal. They are human history and American history and, you know, personal histories. And it doesn't get lighter. And I think, you know, what you can take is that you're doing your best to tell this story so that the story might change the future. You know, I have two kids, and I think when I work, I'm like, I kind of see it as taking a hit. You know, you're like, well, all right, maybe I'm helping to do something to make the world slightly better by telling this story as well as I can. And especially, you know, when you're telling true stories, that's wonderful. When you're telling narrative stories, that's also wonderful. And you have these opportunities to help make things matter. And I think, yeah, I wouldn't be doing what I do if it wasn't for my faith in storytelling and the importance of it.
Well, it's very, very effective scoring there. And it goes, you know, you were saying like kind of you needed to find your orchestra. But some of the most effective parts for me, I think it was just, it sounded like drumsticks on a desk. I was just listening to it and it blew me away. I don't know why that part in particular so much blew me away. Do you happen to know the cue I'm talking about? It sounded just like drumsticks tapping on a desk.
I think they are, in fact, drumsticks tapping on this desk. I think there was a somewhat more complicated cue that was first envisioned for that moment, but it was too much. And I think, paring back and not being afraid to say very little. It was required.
Yeah, no, it's very effective. Like I said, it adds to the whole, as I was watching it, I was like, okay, I just want to kind of get a sense of the music. And then I was like, nope, I can't get the sense of the music from 20 minutes. I got to watch the whole episode. I was like, nope, oh, I got to watch more than one episode. There's a lot of different music in here. So
there is. And by the time you get to actually the fifth episode, it opens up in whole new ways. I mean, it really, across the series, I think there's, they were not scored in sequence, but there are some episodes that required a slightly modulated voice. So something that was a little bit different from the others.
Going into the premise of the series, the 14th Amendment, basically, when the Constitution was written, it kind of says, okay, everybody is equal. And then the courts kind of keep pushing the line. So there's a line drawn in the sand, and then the court system moves the line a little bit more, and then moves the line a little bit more. So then we have the Civil War, and then like, okay, cool, the line is in the sand, everyone's equal. And then the states start moving the line a little bit more. So eventually the 14th Amendment says, okay, we're going to spell this out as clear as possible. Everyone is equal. And then they're still trying to push the line, for something as simple as equality. So this whole series is trying to, I think, like I said, I've only seen the first two episodes, but the whole series is trying to bring home the point that we have this in our system of law. Everyone is equal. Why can't we just interpret this the way it's supposed to be interpreted? I mean, would you agree that that's kind of the goal of the series?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's as much to educate everyone. I think it's very much trying to educate everyone as to what the 14th Amendment is and what it can provide and what it can be. So that there is an absolute agenda, and I think that is a push for equality and recognizing that we have the means to get there. It's not as if it hasn't been thought before. It's interesting because like when I think, or we talked a little bit about going to school and not really knowing very much about the 14th Amendment, but one of the things you come out of school, or at least I came out of school thinking, we have our branches of government and the judicial system does this one thing, and we know where the Supreme, we think of the Supreme Court as not necessarily infallible, but as this set of people who are at a remove, they're unbiased and they're going to make sure that the laws are applied as they should be. But watching through the series, and I think, of course, we have our current moment and recognizing very much the peril of even the idea of an unbiased court system. But when I was growing up, that wasn't how it was presented. It was presented very much as the possibility of being this unbiased court system. But the series makes it very plain to see that that's never been the case, not even for a moment.
Yeah. And that's a very powerful thing that, it's great that we are living in an age where the stuff that you didn't learn in school, you can relearn it as an adult pretty effectively and in ways that are pretty easy to do. Like, yeah, okay, I'm going to sit down and let Will Smith teach me about the American history. Okay, great. Yeah. I'm going to watch a whole bunch of A-list actors with an amazing score and production value kind of teach me what I should have learned in like fifth grade. Okay, good. It's actually a good way. And obviously, they brought all this A-list talent to this, I think, because everybody realizes this is something that we need to bring home in our society about equality. I think over the past year, we've seen that. And, you know, this is something that everybody cares about. I'm assuming everybody cares about this because I don't think they have the budget to possibly have paid all these A-list actors what their normal rate is. So they must have been interested in this topic enough to participate in this. So, it's an easy watch for a very difficult watch, if that makes any sense. Did that make any sense?
Probably no, it does. It does. I mean, it's something that's very digestible for
digestible is the word
for the subject matter. Cause it is very heavy subject matter. There are some beautiful moments. I think those first three episodes are dealing, you know, largely with the, creation, how the history of the 14th Amendment, and then its early implementation, and then the role in civil rights, and then we move through the series into women's rights, and then we move into equal marriage protection, and as well as immigration. So, like, it really just like the way that equality is not equality for some, but equality for all. That part of the story is not lost. And I think that that's so important to all of it, you know, is that it isn't just equality for a small group of people or for even a large group of people. It's for everyone. And it is a pretty digestible way to learn that.
Show and the 14th Amendment in general, it's not just about racial equality. It is about, you know, male and female equality, rights for homosexuals, rights for just anybody, immigrants. It's everybody is equal, and it's, you know, it's just another way that we have to keep spelling it out. Everybody is equal. Oh, but does that include these people? Yes, it includes those people. Oh, does that include this? Yes, it includes. What don't you get about the word everybody, right?
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I think it's great that we have all these voices coming together to talk about this. And you were saying that, you know, this was a little bit easier for you to score this very intense topic, because you've done this before. This is, what, your 12th doc or something like that? You've done a lot of documentaries before this.
I have, yeah.
How did you kind of get started writing music for documentaries?
The first project I ever did was a documentary. I did a co-score with Dan Romer and another friend of ours, Oscar Chibebe, and that was a documentary. It was The Last Season by Sarah Doza, which is just a lovely film. It was the first thing that I got to do, and I mean, it was gentle, and there wasn't a ton of music, but the music that we made was directly sort of linked to music that we'd been making on stages prior to that. So, you know, we played in a band for a long time together, Dan and my buddy Oscar and I, along with a group of other people. And the music kind of flowed from that aesthetic. And so that was my first experience. The next thing I did, Dan and I actually, I think, scored Finders Keepers after that as well. So it was very much him and I working together. But then at the same time as Finders Keepers was being made, Keith Maitland was working on Tower. And Keith and I had always, we'd been friends for well over a decade at that point. And we'd always intended to work on a film together. It just so happened that he was making documentaries. The first project that we tried to work on together was upended by essentially, I guess, ethanol subsidies, which he was making a film about farmers and the plight of small family farms, when all of a sudden they got a huge boost through ethanol subsidies during the Bush administration, which really made all these subjects of his film millionaires, which was, you know, unfortunate for the story, I guess fortunate for these folks. But then the next thing that he did was Tower. And I worked on that film with him while simultaneously again scoring with Dan and Saul Simon McWilliams' Jim, the James Foley story. And so I guess it was really luck as well as being open. You know, I had a friend who was believed in what I could bring to certain projects, and then at the same time, well, I had multiple friends actually who believed in what I could bring to their projects, and it just turned out that those projects also did well, which is, you know, all of those things are circumstances that happen, and I you know, they're as much out of my control as anything. So I can only give myself and work really hard and try and tell a story as well as I can. But when those things work out, that's great because then I get to hopefully do more. And
I'm sure your music was part of the reason why it did well. I mean,
absolutely. I'm not trying to diminish necessarily my part. I'd more so just acknowledge that you don't always have control. You can make something really wonderful. And, you know, I think the idea that because film is so collaborative, you really need to, or at least for me, I feel like when I'm making music, it all depends as much on the other side of the team, you know, or all the other different parts of the team and what they want to hear and what they're open to. We're all together sort of trying to tell this story. And so with sometimes 10, 20 people working together on a project, making sure that voice is something, I mean, my musical voice as well as the film's voice are cohesive and tell a story that's strong enough that people are going to want to watch it and want to talk about it is, I mean, it's sometimes luck as much as it is, you know, process.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, we kind of in the documentary era right now, especially with all these series and sort of mini series, or I don't even know what they're calling them anymore. Limited series, that's what they're calling them now. Limited series, and now we have limited docuseries. But it seems like this is the time that people are really enjoying documentary film, and in such a way that we can extend out, you know, because normally after a good doc, you're like, that was really interesting. I want to learn more about that. I wish they would do a follow-up or something like that, and they rarely do, but in this setting, you know, you guys literally did 5 follow-ups, right? Because you have 6 episodes. So I'm really curious to see how many docs are going to be start to draw themselves out over multiple episodes, because I think it's a perfect format for documentary film.
It really can be. I think, you know, especially if the filmmaking is as exciting and as dynamic certainly as in Amend.
Yeah. Yeah. Where did you get started? Like, how did you grew up in New York, did you say, outside of New York?
Yeah, I mostly grew up here. I moved here from South America when I was 8, my family. And
Where in South America?
Suriname, South America, which is the only Dutch-speaking country on the continent.
Really?
tiny little country, and that's where my family's from. So I came here and pretty much learned how to speak English watching cowboy movies and martial arts films and, of course, going to school like normal people. But that was my Saturday stuff, and I really took it in. I rode horses for years, and starting in Suriname when I was a kid. So
What kind of horse riding was it?
Mostly I just Western. Asked.
Okay.
Sorry, what were you going to say? I cut you off. Yeah,
well, no, I just asked because I recently started doing some horseback riding myself.
Oh, wonderful.
And it's amazing how, I don't know, at one point the horse stopped really rather quickly. And I was realizing, oh, Yeah, like I could have easily gone flying from this thing, like, you know, and I've got like the helmet on and everything like that, but it's like, these are powerful, powerful animals.
They really are, and they're amazing. You know, I haven't ridden regularly in maybe 20 years, you know, ever since it was up to me to pay for lessons and pay for so now, ever since I've mostly taken the occasional trail ride, which I love, you know, I've gotten to ride up in the White Mountains out in Arizona a bunch, and had done some riding across the high desert over there, which is amazing. But yeah, I sort of really gravitated towards the whole idea of cowboy music and the singing cowboys and all of that when I was a kid. And I think that there's no accident between that, or there's like probably a reason that I loved that stuff and then grew to love American folk music, not being, being a first generation American, I guess, is,
Like the Marconi stuff that you got into, or
I love that stuff too. Yeah, I mean, definitely. I that was like a little bit probably more more advanced than the Gene Autry stuff and all the singing cowboy stuff. I mean, gotcha. I really, yeah.
Very cool. Yeah, and as far as the, did you, were you always a composer, or did you start off as a performer?
I started off just as a songwriter and performer. I played in bands as a kid. I never actually, the idea of being a composer never even occurred to me that somebody was writing the music for all the things I was watching. You know, it's just sort of, it was music that existed. The only, again, it's like this, no one in my family was involved in the arts. So there was no one to sort of guide me along my way. I thought like, oh, well, if I want to make music, so this is the way to make it. And the only people that you saw making it were the people who were on stages. You know, we didn't talk about that. And I wasn't somebody who was inclined to listen to teachers or anyone. So at some point, though, I tried a bunch of different things in college. I thought I was going to be a psychologist like my father. And I wasn't, and I am not. It just did not turn out that way.
Well, you said your father is a psychologist?
He is, yeah.
Wow, yeah. That could either be a blessing or a curse, I think, depending on...
For sure. Yeah, you know, it's... I tried, and it didn't... My third attempt at college was the one where I was like, oh, well, maybe I'll just do some music stuff, the thing that's... I keep doing.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's the... I forget who I was just talking to that they said, make sure that you know what you're going, make sure you love what you're going to end up doing for the rest of your life. But the problem is you can't decide what you love until you've done it.
So, right. Absolutely.
You kind of have to walk a little bit down a path, and then it's hard to change gears. But if you find something you love, it's, Sana, something I imagine that once you realize you love music, it was pretty easy for you to change gears. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I'd always known I loved music, and no matter, that was the sort of the through line for everything I ever did. It was more so that I didn't come from a family where that was an accepted reality that you could maybe do that for a living. And ultimately, like when I, even going to school for music, I decided to go, just because I figured, I should probably have a degree in something. And I'm tired of working late nights at bars as bouncer. I weigh, you know, under 200 pounds. There's no way I can keep doing this for all my life. So when I finally went back to school, it was really just, I was like, well, I'll just learn a little bit more about this, and then we'll see what happens. And,
yeah. And where did you end up going to school?
Went to SUNY Purchase.
Okay, great. Yeah, that's a really fantastic school for music in general. It's that's upstate New York, is that right?
Yeah. It's in Westchester County, and yeah, that's where I met a bunch of really wonderful composers. There were a bunch of great work people doing work there when I was there, both performers and composers. Dan Deacon was there while I was there. Dan Roman was there while I was there. Langhorne Slim, who's like a, you know, like folk rock human being. There were a lot of us there doing stuff.
So when so then you started doing doing docs, and I see a lot of docs. Is it do you want to do both docs and narratives, or are you pretty comfortable staying with documentary film?
I absolutely want to tell all the stories, all the good stories. Yeah. I've been really fortunate in doc work. Again, you know, it's sort of been cascading effect where I did a couple of things that I helped to tell a couple of great stories. And as a result, I've gotten to tell more great stories. And, you know, I've done one narrative feature at this point, and I hope to do a lot more.
Is that Farewell and More?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah, I've got your IMDb pulled up. Don't worry, this isn't off the top of my head. Yeah, that's it's funny because you know I've spoken to a couple documentary composers, and you know it just seems like what you said, they are attracted to the story. I mean, it's all one form or another. It's all storytelling, so. It's kind of the same thing. I know Jeff Beal, you know, he's done some amazing docs, but he also does really amazing television composition. So it's, if there are directors with narrative films, Ose has some music for you. So
come on,
contact
down.
His agent.
That's right.
So how did you land this project, Amend? How did you meet the producers, director, et cetera?
Adam Weber worked on that project, and he brought me into the fold. So yeah, he's a friend, and
great.
Just sort of, you know, word of mouth.
Wow. Was it a pretty natural fit, or did you have to do like demo things like that for them?
No, there was no demoing. It was, I mean, you know, there was a lot of sort of discussion. There were a lot of moving parts in the team. So I guess we had, besides Netflix, who was involved right from the beginning, there was Will Smith's team, which was Overbrook, which is now Westbrook. And there was the doc group. And then later on, there was also, gosh, I'm trying to recall, Rock, Paper, Scissors, which also has changed their name now. So there were a lot of different teams that that sort of needed to coordinate and get everything together. And obviously, there are so many actors, and there were so many different different experts that were interviewed, that there were just a lot of moving parts early on in the process. So it took a little while to get going. And once it did, it really sped up quite a bit.
Yeah. For our listeners that are outside of the film industry, it's not just, you know, oh, this film is by Warner Brothers, this film is by Paramount. It's nowadays, this film is by six or seven smaller production companies, and then it gets bought by a bigger production company, and then Netflix gets involved, and then, you know, so that's why you have all those beginning title sequences with all the different production companies, because it takes a lot of people backing and being interested in a film for it to see the light of day these days. So, but I imagine once Will Smith was involved, it kind of skyrocketed pretty quickly. So
yeah, I mean, I think he was definitely involved way before I was. I think they had filmed everything with all of the talking heads even by the time that I was brought on board.
Yeah, that's often the case, I think, for narratives. But it's good. Well, I guess it's interesting to hear that sometimes it's that way for docs as well, because I think that's one thing that is good often about docs is it seems like they're more interested in hearing music earlier in the process. Whereas if you get a narrative feature, you know, it seems like these days it's 6 weeks out, they start looking for their composer. And it's like, come on, man, why don't you just give us a little bit more heads up? So, but you had a pretty quick turnaround, or about how long did it take you to write this music for this
series?
Well,
ultimately the music, there were a few cues in place, but by the time that we really got to it, it was all done in about 6 weeks, I think. Yeah. But yeah, there were a couple of like early sort of looking into what we were making, you know?
Yeah. So, wow. Well, yeah, that, I guess that's the current deadline, 6 weeks. That's how long you have.
And yeah. I mean, maybe it was a little bit longer than 6 weeks. It wasn't significantly longer than 6 weeks.
Wow. And was this recorded or how much of this was done with live musicians, and did you have to deal with pandemic issues as far as recording?
It was a mixture for this project. Because of the short timeline, I couldn't record quite as many as I would have wanted to. Yeah. So I just did a whole lot of processing on virtual instruments and blended with real instruments wherever I could. I played a bunch of instruments. I had other percussionists play some along with me. I had Adam Criscow, actually. I think he was the solo percussionist on stuff besides myself. And then I played some other instruments. We had some string players come in for parts that really couldn't be faked. And yeah, that's most of it.
Well, the series, again, it's very enlightening, very well done. The music, again, takes twists and turns around every single corner, and you navigate everything very well. Again, the series is Amend, The Fight for America. It's streaming on Netflix as we speak, hosted by Will Smith and starring just about every actor you've ever seen in Hollywood. And the music, of course, was done by Ose Aset. Anything you'd like to say kind of in closing here, Ose?
Thanks a lot for having me, of course. And to all your listeners, definitely do watch Amend, The Fight for America.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, that will do it for this week on Hooked on Score. I want to remind our listeners to check out our Patreon page. You can follow us on Twitter at Hooked on Score. You can follow me on Twitter at Rick Urban. Ose, do you want to give out any kind of website information or social media handles?
I have no social media. I do have a website. If anybody ever wants to write to me, I'll do my best to write you back. You go to oseaset.com.
All right. Well, again, I want to thank Ose for being here. We will see you next week on another episode of Hooked on Score.
All right, everyone. That's our show. Bye.